At this time, I would like to introduce our second speaker. Her name is Monique, or Nikki, and she's from the D.C. area. Let's welcome her. Come.
Woo! I'm an addict. My name is Monique, or Nikki. I told Maurice to tell the gays not to leave when he finished. Because the goddamn meeting's still going on, poo. And I'm next. Listen, I'm so nervous. My heart is racing because I don't know how to like share certain aspects of my story and hold stuff back. So when I get up here, like, I feel extremely vulnerable because when I finish, I feel exposed. So here goes. I got clean sometime, actually it was January 1st, 1986. And I came to my first NA meeting. I didn't know what to expect. All I knew is I couldn't stop using, and my mother knew a guy who was in recovery that she worked with. And he, when I talked to him, he asked me if I thought I had a problem and I could come to an NA meeting. And I said, nah, I don't think I'm that bad. If I get that bad, I'll call you. And then I think a couple of months later, I found myself up on 14th and W trying to sell a broke one-step camera while I was on my period. Because I couldn't trick, and I had tricked with the Mexican, and he wouldn't buy the camera. And then he tried to take his money back after he found out I was on my period. So, when that didn't work out, I found my way back home and told my mother to make that call for me, and she did. And the guy told me to meet him at a meeting, and he would get me home. And that started the process of recovery for me. I came to meetings every single day for, I think, the first 5 years. I didn't talk because I was scared. I didn't know how to talk. I took a public speaking class, and that shit ain't work. I couldn't share in a meeting. And y'all told me that it wasn't about none of that stuff, that I needed to come in here, and I needed to learn how to be vulnerable, and I needed to learn how to become who I am and accept it. And I couldn't do that, so I stopped coming. And I found some other stuff to do. And found myself in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1996, drinking wine over a snow-capped landscape, and eventually I ended up smoking crack again. In 1996, I don't know that I believed that I was an addict because I came in here off the street and I had not experienced what I now know to be my bottom. And I was in Minnesota, like, smoking, and I managed to fit 10 years worth of recovery in a stem. Everything that I had acquired, everything that I knew how to do, and everything that I was became about getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. And I did that, and I remember selling everything that I had, trying to get back home. I remember calling my friends who were all in recovery at the time, saying, you know, I'm up here and I'm using, and I don't know what to do. And them telling me to go to a meeting, find a meeting, and I went to a meeting, and, you know, they was all white, and I identified out immediately because I was all black. And you know, I was in there, and I remember saying to them, like, this guy was sharing, and he came, he had just come out of treatment, and he said he wanted to talk about the spirituality of a butterfly. And I ain't see it. I couldn't see nothing spiritual about a butterfly. You know, all I knew is I couldn't stop smoking. And I was getting ready to lose my job. And my job was my life, you know, at that point. And you know, I was selling everything that I had. Everything that I had was at the pawn shop by then. And I remember calling my mother and telling her, and she, got the church to put together some money and send me some money to come home. It took a 12-hour trip, took 2 days. It took me 2 days to get back here from Minnesota. We hitched up what was left and what we could fit on the little U-Haul truck and drove cross country. And by the time I got here, the guy that I was with at the time decided he didn't want to use no more. And I moved back to Landover and decided that I needed to find the crack. And I did that. And I'm a property manager by profession. And I got my job back because when I left there, I was a productive member of society, so they didn't know what was coming back to them. And when I got back, I was like a full-blown crackhead. And I managed to take a community and turn it into a whole crack community. People was paying me in rocks. I stopped going to work. I didn't do anything that had to do anything with anything that was about living. Everything I was doing was about dying. You know, eventually, I couldn't even go to work. My job was from here to, my apartment was here, and the office was where Pam is sitting, and I couldn't make it. On most days, I couldn't make it. I remember being so toxic that, you know, I was just like in the bathtub for a whole night. And when I got out, I still stunk. People kept trying to help me to get clean. Y'all kept telling me mine was a life worth saving and, you know, you don't have to use even if you want to, you can do this. And, you know, I remember not being able to put 60 days together. Eventually, they sent me to treatment, you know, and I got to the treatment center. And, you know, I still had some options. I still had a few things, so by the time I got there, the guy wanted to put me on medication, and, you know, I felt like that wasn't the best course of action. So I bucked. And he told the people that I worked for when they fired me and locked me out of my place. I remember going on a strip and finding some dope boys and getting them to climb through the window and renting that apartment to them and telling them everything that was in it they could have, you know, if they just got me in and give me some crack. And they did, and I used, and I left them in there. And by the time I got to my mother's house, let me just fast forward. I turned her house upside down. My mother was the only person who loved me all through that at that time. And she trusted everything that I said, and she trusted, you know, everything that I did. And I remember lying so much and stealing so much that by the time I got to the end or near the end, she had gotten like a black belt in Aranon, right? And she wasn't going for nothing. So I remember calling her from the phone booth on the corner saying, "Ma, they're going to get me. They're going to kill me if I don't have their money, and I need $40. And I knew she was done when she said, "Baby, I'm going to pray for you, you know, because I ain't got no more money." And I knew that I needed to do something about myself, but I didn't. I continued to use. And y'all would come out there. I remember Pam came out there, and I was on the corner. I think I got my first trick charge at 32 years old. And actually, it was my first real charge, period. And I didn't know how to, you know, be a crack whore, none of that stuff. And I knew that, you know, it was unusual when they told me $10 was the going rate. You know, and I thought it was a little low. I thought at that time I could get a few dollars more, but they weren't going for it. Them crack whores had messed up the game entirely. So I had to go for 10. I took the 10, and I became probably the worst crack whore on the crack whore strip. I failed miserably as a crack whore. I remember being out there in sub-degree temperatures and not being able to go home, even though I wanted to desperately. I remember coming to meetings and not being able to not use, even though I had experienced the process of recovery. I remember y'all telling me over and over, "You don't have to use even if you feel like it." I remember desperation just becoming my entire existence. I sold my mother's TV 3 times while she was in the hospital, you know? I took everything that I could take from her. You know, the people who loved me were the people who I just, like, demolished. people came and bought me water in the dead of the summer, and you know, and people came and asked me if I was ready all through the winter, you know, and I just couldn't. I couldn't stop. I remember being out there and being so desperate that, like, I would trick with people, and if they demanded that I didn't use protection, I used protection. You know, I remember the last time I went to detox. I was over to D.C. General Detox, and I wanted a cigarette. And at that time, they weren't allowing people to smoke. So the only way I could get a cigarette was to go over to the STD clinic, you know, and bum a cigarette. So I told them, you know, that I had this itch, right? And I was scratching. And they took me over to the STD clinic, and, you know, I didn't know at the time that they gave me all those tests. That was part of it, right? So I got the cigarette because that's all I really wanted. I didn't care whether I had anything or not. I just wanted the cigarette. I got back to the clinic, and, you know, they released me, and I'm at home at my mother's house, and the lady came to the house, the nurse. She said, baby, she had a Jamaican accent, you better come with me. I didn't know. And by the time they got me back over to the clinic, she said, they told me I had 5 venereal diseases. I had syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, something else and something else. And they could not allow me to stay on the street without being treated. So I said, okay. She came and got me, and she had a little Volkswagen, I remember. And it was a warm summer day. And took me back over to the STD building, and they shot me up with a bunch of stuff. And she brought me back home, and I commenced to doing what I do. I continued to use. And I remember the guy who I was seeing at the time, and he was somebody who was not using. And I remember having to call him and tell him that I had all of that. And he was like, damn, you're a walking cesspool. I said, well, I smoke crack, you know, what the fuck is wrong with you? Because you knew that I was subject to be something like that, and you came and got me anyway. Because the whole thing was, I really felt bad about who I was and who I had become, and, you know, he probably felt bad that he couldn't stop fucking with me because of who I was and who I had become, and he tried to make me feel like what I was something lower than life. And I got that strength, the courage to explain that from the women in recovery. Because y'all told me, despite all of that, that mine was a life worth saving. You know, when I smoke crack, I turn into somebody that is unrecognizable. I am not this fierce diva that stands before you today. I am hideous. When I got arrested the last time, I got locked up every 2 weeks on a Thursday, 3 times in a row. And I don't know if it was the same officer or not to this day. I know the last time they locked me up, it was a trick charge. And I got over to the jail. The dude in processing said they had just electronic, you know, did the system and made it electronic. And they were taking pictures and putting them on your armband at the time. And he said, you want to take a new picture or you want to use the one that's in here? And I said, I don't know. What you think? He looked at me, he looked at the picture, he said, you better keep this one. You know, I was hideous, one eye open, one eye closed. And in the end, I had this short haircut, and you know, the only thing that I could do was to throw some dye in it and make myself look different. And when it got real bad, like I had smoked so much crack that my voice sounded like this. So when I got in a car with people, they look at me, you know, because they'd be a little startled when they say, what's up? And then I say, what's up? And they'd be like, is you a man or a woman? You know, and one time I got in a dude's car, and he said, I like a girl that got big titties. So I just looked at him, and I popped them out, and they wasn't voluptuous no more. They just fell, you know. They just fell flat. Like an empty water balloon. He said, I like him a little more voluptuous than that. I said, okay. You know, I remember The last day though, oh my God, I was so tired. I had on some turned over flip flops and I probably hadn't taken a bath in 10 days. I knew that I was at the end. I got in the car with this dude, my feet hurt so bad, and it was early in the morning. I hated when the sun caught me up because I was that addict that moved more comfortably through the alleyways than I did walking on the main streets and thoroughfares. I hated seeing people do normal stuff like getting themselves ready and going to work. And it was something like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and a guy pulled over and I would see this guy, but he never said anything to me. And he said, come here. And I went to the car and I remember getting in and he put $5 up on the dashboard and said what he wanted. And I looked at him. I said, well, I cost more than that. And he said, that's all I got. And put it up there. And I said, okay. Because I was desperate. And desperation ruled. And I really did try to do it, y'all. But the dude stunk so bad. He smelled like I don't know, the dump. And when he pulled it out, it had all this cheese around it. And it was just like, eh. I said, damn. Did you take a bath? He said, hell no, not today. And I knew that I needed to do something different. I didn't have the strength to run. I grabbed the $5 and stuck it in the place what would have been my breast. And I just jumped on out the car, and I was praying he ain't chase me because I couldn't run. And I got out there, and I remember crying so hard that I got on my knees on the ground in the middle of West Virginia Avenue. And I said, Lord, please, this cannot be what you got for me. And I remember just like being so disgusted with who I had become and running out of people to call, you know, and I just like got up and I would pray. I would pray that God sent me a trick that was going to be nice to me. You know what I'm saying? That would be my prayer. And I go. I remember being out there, you know, in the middle of the night and in the wee hours of the morning and in empty abandoned apartments. And I know that God had his hand on my life. I stand before you disease free. I have nothing. I have nothing. I barely got high blood pressure. It's regulated. And, you know, I got a little excess weight. But that's about it. And, yeah, I mean, I know that it ain't because I was no hell of a crack whore. I know that my life does not belong to me today. I believe when they say that miracles do happen, that I am a true miracle. Because everything that I did and everything that I was about dying. I didn't have anything in me that would help me to stay alive. I remember the last day the police jumped out on me and took me to jail. I had a warrant, and he took me in, and the judge processed me, and they sent me up. And I told you I had those clothes on. I had on for 10 days, and I just was, like, so tired. I knew I was going to be in for a minute, and I stayed in there for 45 days, y'all. I remember my mother had written a letter to the judge, and she would come and drag herself over to the jail to see me, and how bad I felt about it because my mother was sick, you know. At that time, she wasn't a well woman, and, you know, she didn't have no money, and I had demolished her house and turned it into an awful, awful place. And she would still catch the bus over there with her last little pennies. And I remember the last time she came, she was so tired. And she looked at me and she said they had made her stand in that little room before they come in there for like 2 hours. And, you know, and they searched her and all of that stuff. And she had to go and try to catch the last bus to get back. And I remember my heart just like dropping. I felt so bad. I told her, just don't come back. Just don't come back, because I knew it must have been a harrowing experience for her, because that's not anything that she was used to. And because those were the choices that I had made, I was so sorry. I was so sorry that I had made that her way of life. And at that moment, I knew that I had really had enough. So I remember she wrote a letter to the judge, and I had somehow, y'all, from 1997, when I came back from Minnesota, to 2001, I had the same court-appointed attorney, and it was this African guy. And this particular time, I had gotten arrested, and the guy jumped out on me and took me in there, and she wrote a letter to the judge, and the judge decided to hold me for a time and get, you know, grant me the opportunity to go back to treatment, and I had to wait for the treatment people to come. And I remember the judge coming back then. They do that assessment that they do, and they take your urine. I had been in jail for 45 days, and the guy came back there. He was all upset, and he said, "Oh, my God, I can't believe you are using drugs in the jail." I said, "I ain't used no drugs. What are you talking about?" 45 days later, I was still pissing dirty. I was that toxic. I was like, "Look, I don't know what to tell you. And your mother, I am doing everything I can to keep you out of jail. And she is trying to put you in the jail. I don't know what she told the judge, but you can forget about it now. You will not be going home." I remember laughing because despite everything, I knew that if ain't nobody else loved me, she loved me. And I knew that whatever she told the judge was just so she could sleep at night. You know, she knew that if I was somewhere away or somewhere in treatment, that she didn't have to worry about them calling and saying, "We found her body." You know, my biggest fear when I was out there was that they would call me and say, "Your mother's dead," you know, or find me, or I would find out long after it happened, because when I used, I couldn't get back home. Sometimes it'd be 2 and 3 months. And they would tell me, "Your mother looking for you," because the whole entire circumference of my existence was in a radius of a block, about 3 or 4 blocks, really. North, south, east, and west. You know, like, I didn't go that far. And I just couldn't find surrender nowhere. You know, I remember an addict picked me up. Fuck that, it was Barbara. I hated that bitch, y'all. She picked me up off my strip and took me to the women's rep. And I was so upset with her. I was like, "I ain't tell you I wanted to go to no goddamn meeting. If I wanted to go to a meeting, I know how to find a meeting." And I remember, but y'all just wouldn't let me die. Y'all would not let me die. And I would say stuff like, "Why don't y'all just leave me alone? I know how to find recovery when I want it." And I didn't mean that, though. I didn't mean that. I really wanted my life back. I really did. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful to each and every one of y'all for just loving me and being in there and just, like, you know, judging me and all of the stuff that we do, you know, when we use, being hardcore and all of that stuff. Die, bitch, hurt, bitch, all of the stuff, you know, that we do. Because all of it matters. And I heard all of it when I was trying to make a decision whether or not to use again. I've been clean now for 10 years. 10 years. And for 5 years, I wasn't sure that I was going to make it back. I was not sure. It was a struggle. It was a whole struggle. For that whole first year, I wanted to use. Everything that I did and everything that I thought, I associated with using. When I got my period and I was having PMS, I felt like I wanted to use because I couldn't identify anything that was normal. You know, when I got mad at somebody, I felt like I wanted to use because I didn't know that it was normal to have emotions. You know, all that I had become was like that individual who was non-existent and irrelevant in a world full of people. And I didn't know anything about the emotional changes and everything that I knew intelligently didn't make no difference. You know what I'm saying? When I got here, I met a man who is now my husband, in the women's rap. And I remember being like in that relationship for the first year and not knowing how to, much less be in a relationship, but to be a wife to somebody. And this guy loving me all through all of that, right? And I remember being this awful individual and thinking that I had to manage everything about everything and be this like super fantastic person, and I couldn't be vulnerable, and I couldn't be needy, and I couldn't be none of that stuff. And I remember just like experiencing the turbulence of the trial and errors of relationships in that relationship. I remember him coming home and telling me probably 9 months into the marriage that he had been with somebody else. And I was thinking, God damn, what the fuck you tell me that shit for? I was all right. I was all right not knowing. You know what I'm saying? I was really all right living in that whatever it was that I was living in, because I was like, that's some ninth step shit that you really shouldn't be bringing to me. You know, why did you tell me that? I remember being devastated and not knowing how to manage that. You know, I remember talking to the people who I entrusted with my life and them giving me all of these different things to do and ways to be and all of that stuff, and not knowing how to deal with that shit. I was like, look, motherfucker, when you go to the goddamn meeting, don't be sharing that shit. You know? It was hard. It was hard. You know, it was like that vicious cycle that we get caught up in when we come in here and we don't allow ourselves to be who the fuck we are. You know? And I found myself like living in the embarrassment of his choices. You know? Until I realized that that's his fucking problem. Not mine. So I didn't have to do that. And I remember being so afraid that at some point in that process, I wasn't sure if I was going to make it through, you know? I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to manage any of that shit clean, because I was still hiding behind that person who wouldn't come in here and let y'all know that I experienced this stuff, you know? Like, I couldn't come in here and tell y'all that I want to use. I couldn't come in here and tell y'all that I'm feeling some kind of way because my husband was unfaithful. I couldn't come in here and tell y'all all of that stuff because I ain't really want y'all to judge me, even though I said I ain't care. You know? I'm all right with it now. Fuck all y'all. Just in case y'all ain't sure. So, right now what I'm saying is my life is my responsibility. And my mental health is my responsibility. And if I allow it, too many people would have me be a psycho. And I have absolutely no desire to be a psycho. So I try to do things that would take care of myself these days. And sometimes it seems like, you know, that selfish part of this process that we talk about, you know, it's a fine line. You know, but sometimes I feel like I have to say no. I have to say no. I have to say I ain't interested. I have to say, fuck you. I'm not doing that, you know, or whatever it takes to make sure that I don't repeat that situation ever again. And it's tough. One of the things that I'm doing now is I think I'm living my dream. I have decided just recently to embark on some things, and I decided to move into comedy, and I've been doing stand-up comedy, and the thing has taken off so fast that, like, last week I did a show in this club that I felt so good. I remember it was that same feeling. It was that same feeling when I moved to Minneapolis and, you know, ended up smoking crack over the snow-capped mountain and shit. And I identified the elation, right? And I ran to a meeting and told, you know, because Lord knows I don't want to smoke no more rocks. I don't think I can hit another rock and be, you know, like, I'm too old to be a crack whore. You know what I'm saying? That shit is just not a good look. It's not a good time for that stuff, you know, and it get way too cold now. I don't know what happens. I remember being in them crack houses and not worrying about no roaches or rats and shit now. I can't even be in a room with a bug now. You know what I'm saying? Without losing my mind. I just can't imagine. I don't know what happened, but I just don't want to use. You know, and y'all told me that I have to be willing to be honest in here and just tell the whole truth. I got to have somebody that I tell the whole truth to. So on them days when I'm just not sure, like I come in here and I run the risk of y'all doing what we do, judging me and, you know, being vulnerable and exposing this thing for exactly what it is. Because if I don't, then it has the potential to devastate. This is the only disease known to man that would convince the person who bears it that it does not exist. And on a day like today, with this outfit, I could be convinced, you know, that I ain't no addict. And I might be able to drink me a glass of wine or something. And that's how it started. You know what I'm saying? So I have to tell y'all that that's the shit that run through my mind. And it's really hard, because when I'm in those clubs, you know what I'm saying? I watch people and I watch their process and I watch it on my job too. And it's like, it's a transformation that occurs from first drink to whenever they finish, you know? And I find myself wondering what it's like. You know what I mean? Like them green drinks and them pink drinks and all that pretty shit they do, you know? But so what I do is I tell them, look, I'm a recovering crack whore. I can't smoke hookah, I don't drink, or do none of that shit, okay? I don't even want to walk too close to the fucking bar. I don't want nothing liquid, so I chew ice the whole time I'm in there. I got these new teeth, so I got to, like, get the ice to melt a little bit because I don't want to break my new teeth up. You know, them Johnson's fierce. So I just have to expose it on every level. And it's risky, because sometimes they look at me and they be like, really? You smoke crack? Really. And I smoked a lot of it. And we'll smoke it again if I don't pay attention. So it's really not about what you think, it's about what I know. And what I know is I can't smoke another rock, not one more. Anyway, I'm an addict. My name is Nikki, and thank y'all for listening.
Hi, my name is Pam, and I'm an addict. We're going to close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer right